for the last, certainly for the last year, and for quite a bit of time leading up to that, on many occasions, Swamiji would say to us, I really don't know how much longer I can go in this body. He was just weaker and weaker. His nurse said it was just increasingly complicated to keep his fluid levels correct. The congestive heart failure last year, he was hospitalized with renal failure, and it's just been one after another. And each time, it would be a little less energy, but then he would resurrect and write another book or a commentary on Patanjali. As someone said, Swamiji would say on one hand, oh, I'm just so weak and exhausted, I can't go on. Why don't I do a world tour? So it's always been a little hard to know sort of where it was going to be. And but at the same time, I've said to myself many times, when he does leave this world, we won't be able to say he didn't warn us that it was about to happen. First time I remember most vividly when he was most serious was in 2003, when he really thought his life was over. He just finished writing Conversations with Master. He was living in Assisi, and he just felt very weak, and he also had finally finished writing. When he was a young monk, Master had told him to take notes of what Master said, and he had these notebooks, and when he finished Conversations with Master, everything in the notebooks had been put into a book. And that, as far as he was concerned, was the end of his assignment. And he just felt his heart would always give him trouble. And he would talk on the phone, and I remember one particular day him saying, he said, I was so close to the edge last night. He said, I could have just slipped away without hardly having to make any effort, I think is what he was saying. I wouldn't even have to try to leave the body. And I said, well, Swamiji, you've done the work of 10 men. You've transformed the lives of thousands of us. It would be nothing but selfish on my part or any of us to ask you to stay 1 minute longer than you really feel that you need to. And then I said to him, but sir, it really won't be as much fun to be on this planet. You know, he was more active then, and for those of us who have had the opportunity to see him, his periodic appearance in our lives always made this planet a little more livable. He was so sweet and so serious when he answered, because he was remembering back to when he was 25 years old and Master died. And he just said very sweetly, I know, he said, I've been through it. And I thought that almost all of his life of discipleship was lived after Master went into the infinite. And of course, some of you are younger and newer, and your contacts with Swami have been very intermittent or very slight, or perhaps even not at all. Others of us have had a whole lifetime. So it would be nothing but selfish, especially for someone like myself, who, as I often say, if I never stop talking from this moment till my last breath, I could never begin to repay what's been given to me. I couldn't even begin to touch, make a drop on the ocean. So it's a very strange moment. People have been so sweet, treating me, rightly so, as if my father just died, putting their arms around me, wanting to make sure that I'm okay, which I deeply appreciate. At the same time, this is such a happy day for Swamiji, such an extraordinary, beyond imagination of expectancy, that this is really a glorious celebration, except for the fact that life on this planet won't be as much fun anymore, because he won't periodically come to wherever we are and give us the pleasure of his bliss, essentially. I was completely dry-eyed, just very, oh, well, this is it. I've been expecting for years, every time the phone would ring late at night, that it was going to be that call, and last night it was. 11 o'clock at night, first Devi calls, and she says, I just got a call from Kirtani. Kirtani is the colony leader in Assisi, Swami's, has been in, at his house in Italy for the last couple of months. And Devi says to me, Devi's the, her, she and her husband Jyotish are the world leaders of Ananda, and now Swami's successor is Jyotish. And Devi said, Kirtani just called, and Swami, they're trying to keep Swami breathing. I said, what does that mean? She said, I don't know. That's all she said. So we sort of, okay, we put the phone down, and then 5 minutes later, Kirtani called and said, she said like this, Swami is free. That's what she said. Oh my, my, my. Then the rest of the story came out. He hasn't been sleeping well. He wrote to us several times. He said he's so weak he can't breathe. He has congestive heart failure, which is when your lungs begin to fill up. He says he said he's been so weak he can't breathe. So he hardly sleeps because he can't breathe. So in Assisi, he went to sleep at 2 in the morning on what was Sunday morning, and then woke up about 7. He just got up as he normally gets up. He put on one of his beautiful silk bathrobes, which he loves to wear around. He went right in to check his emails. Even at this point, he stays in touch with everyone. He checked his emails. His cook had said, what would you like for breakfast? Swami didn't speak, but agreed with the proposed menu. And then Miriam, his nurse, who always comes to see him at that time, Narayani, who's been his caretaker for the last few years, and Narayani's husband, Sherjo. Narayani's always lived under the same roof as him for the last few years, and then Sherjo lives there too. So in his split-level house, they have a bedroom downstairs, and Swami's is upstairs, and they've always kept a baby monitor where he is. So as soon as he moved, they would come. So Narayani and Sherjo were there. Miriam comes over, his nurse, to check him every day. And she noticed there was something different about his silence, because she says he's been quite withdrawn. He's actually been in a very exalted spiritual state for several years. And some days it manifests in such a way that he won't relate to this world at all. Increasingly, as I've seen him, he's been more and more withdrawn and less willing to engage. But Miriam sensed something different about his silence. And she sent Jaidara, who cooks for him, running over to the temple to get Kirtani and Anand to come over. And then Miriam herself started to go and get help from Narya, because she thought they might have to take him to the hospital. She walked out of the room, and then Narayani called to Miriam, come back, come back. So Miriam went back into the room, and they managed to move him from the dining room just around the corner into his bedroom and put him on his bed. And he was just barely breathing. And Miriam said even by then he hardly had a pulse. And they started chanting Om in his right ear. When someone is dying and you're present, the hearing is the last sound to go, and a master tells us you chant Om in the right ear of someone who's dying, even after they've left their body for a little while. So they just started chanting Om to him. And Miriam said essentially he took his last breath several times. It was like he was barely breathing, and then it looked like he had passed. And finally, Anand and Kirtani came into the room, and when they were standing in the room, then he actually took his last breath. But it was just as peaceful and as easy. The only thing for me, which I've always thought, that we would have a little time to know it was coming, and I always assumed that some of us would be able to go and have a few days and be there when he passed. In fact, when I thought about it, it was interesting because there was almost no one there. Narayani, Sherjo, Miriam, three who had been taking care of him very closely, Anand and Kirtani walking into the room just as he passed. But in truth, he probably couldn't have gone if all of us who have spent a lifetime with him were there with him. I doubt if he could have walked away from us so easily, and who knows how easily we could have let him go. So he really snuck away. All of this I contemplated quite calmly. I've mentally prepared myself for this. Many years ago, it would have been like about 1996 or 97, when we were in the middle of one of the very difficult periods of Swamiji's life, when Self-Realization Fellowship was suing us, and it was very difficult. And during the middle of that lawsuit, we gained access to, they had to turn over to us some of their private files. And we were given this file that was called the K file, where they had tracked all of Swami's actions and behaviors for all these years, which we knew they were doing and they had denied doing. And that file was given to Swamiji in Europe, where he was, and it verified for him the extent to which people he had loved and revered now saw him no longer as a friend. And after reading that file, he collapsed in a restaurant, and his blood pressure went to nothing, and they had to bring in an ambulance, and somewhere in the middle of Florence, I think it was, they had to take him to the hospital. And he himself, I believe he said at the time, but maybe he said later, he felt no malice toward anyone. He felt that everyone was his brother and sister, and that he could go to God with a completely clear mind and heart at that moment. I was in Ananda Village when that in the phone rang, and someone said, Swami has no blood pressure, virtually no pulse. He's being rushed to the hospital, and they have no idea whether he's going to live or not. And we didn't know. He had already had open heart surgery. It was quite reasonable that he could pass. To my astonishment, I just began to weep, uncontrollably, and I flung myself on the floor next to a bed and put my head on the bed and was just, I didn't even know where it came from. It was just pouring out of me. And after he did recover, and of course that was almost, 15 years ago, perhaps almost 20, but I thought to myself, this is no way for a devotee to respond. After a lifetime of divine friendship, after so much has been given, after all the hope that he places in all of us for being able to carry forward the legacy that he has put into our hearts, minds, and souls, I said, why am I weeping? So from that day, really, until now, I have done my best, and I would be vastly overstating it, because I am always astonished by the feelings that one has in one's own heart that one doesn't even know about until the right door is open. But I have tried always, I will put it, to practice the presence of Swamiji. Because we can't cling. It's antithetical to everything his friendship and his life has meant to us, for us not to be able to live as he lived, which is for God alone, fearlessly opening ourselves to one another, loving without condition, always being true friends, willing to do whatever is needed for each other, for the spiritual welfare of the whole. But when God calls, we don't want to be looking backwards and saying no. And as it happened, it was not his time by quite a lot, but it was my moment to remember. All of you remember, probably, Maria Warner died a year or two ago. She had recurring cancer that went to her brain. She was in Dallas giving a Sunday service. She had a terrible headache, and she intuited that their cancer had gone to her brain. She went ahead and went to the doctor and had it tested, and in fact it had, and 1 month later she was gone. And when her husband, Dave Devarshi, had her in a wheelchair and was pushing her into the hospital, and he became upset. How could you not? She said, practice the teachings. Control the reactive process. What was the third thing? Control the reactive process, live the teachings. And there was one more. But just like in that moment, this is what we have lived for, is to live for God. And if Swamiji lived for one thing, it's to live for God. So anyway, this morning, when we were coming in the car and I was saying to David, I don't think this is real to me yet. And David said, Swamiji is with Master now. And this happened. I thought of him as a 22-year-old boy finding autobiography of a yogi, going across the country, meeting Master for the first time, falling at his feet, I want to be your disciple. He had 3.5 years. And then all the rest of these years, he's had to find it in his own heart. And now, just at that moment, Swami didn't go into the astral world. Swami went into the infinite. And he's going to be able to be able to say, sir, to Master, sir, I did my best for you. I did everything I could that you asked me to do. What a moment. I know what I'll do. The last story in my book about Swamiji. A devotee was marveling at Swamiji's many accomplishments. In one lifetime, you've done the work of 10 men, she said. Perhaps you're right, Swami said quietly. But nothing I have done is important, however, except to the extent that it has helped people individually to deepen their love for God. At the end of this life, Swamiji said, the only thing that will matter to me is, have I been a good disciple? And then the book ends. There was nothing else to say. Let me try to remember what else I wanted to share. Oh, I remember. I feel now that he's passed away, certain things that I didn't say before, I feel like I can say anything now. A number of years ago, he had a friend, a young woman as it were. She was a very sort of only half in this world kind of person. Her consciousness was quite unusual and not that tied to this world. And she gave him a present, which was one of those rather sentimental little figures of a small boy, child, kneeling in prayer. And as a piece of art, it wasn't spectacular. And I was surprised by how sweetly he accepted it, but I thought it was about his friendship with her. But then he put it on the mantle where he could see it. And one day he looked at it and he commented about her. He said, she understands how I see myself. He said, I always just think of myself as a little boy. And, you know, the degree to which I have relied on him to be the only adult I know, really, to just have him turn his own thoughts like that. I always have just seen myself as a little boy. And even Master Yogananda would always talk about Sri Teshwar, his master, much more than we realize. He was always deferring things to Master and to Babaji. We think of Master as being all-powerful, but in his own self, he knew where the power came from. Remember how Master would often say to Rajasi, his most advanced disciple, remember where your power comes from. And Rajasi would say, yes, sir, I know, it comes from you. Amazing impossibility to fathom these relationships. And when Swami said that to me, and I look at this sentimental little figure of this little boy praying, and I look at this, to me, spiritual giant, and I try to put together, you know, how all of these different elements of the spiritual reality just weave together. so that no matter how much one may appear to be, the more expanded and powerful a person becomes on the spiritual path, the less there is of you. To have any feeling of that, the more one becomes like a little child. And especially on our path, where discipleship is everything. And especially on our path where Swamiji has been the personification of what it means to be on that on this path, that childlike humility, that complete willingness to let people think whatever they want about me, that writing that song, I Live Without Fear, after that man who had some, that man had some spiritual power, the man who came to excoriate Swami. He was not nothing. Sometimes people have a certain evil genius. He had a certain evil genius to be able to know what, where you can hurt someone. So it was easy to say that Swami didn't have to take it seriously, but it was a serious attack on him. But he says, Swamiji says, I'm not here to defend my ego. So why would I defend it? If someone wants to slash it to pieces, why would I try to rebuild it? So even though the man had no redeeming qualities or no right to speak, Swami just listened quietly and let him speak like that. Just like a little child, okay, God wants to excoriate me, let him excoriate me. But then he walked over to the piano and that song was right there. That particular song, after he wrote it, he called him, I'm sure I'm not the only one he called, but he called on the telephone to our house. And he said, listen, I've just written this song, and he sang it over the phone. You know, it was so beautifully sweet right over the phone. And then he said, you know, this came after this man came over, and then that's when he said, sweetest revenge. You know, just to be able to turn it completely. And then he said, if I die without doing anything else, this song will have been enough. Swamiji's life was predicted to end by the sage Bhrigu in 2009. And that Bhrigu had been very precise that it would be at his birthday in 2009, and that would be the end of his life. That was the age at which both his parents had passed away. And so it was expected. So when the year, his birthday 2009 came, May 19th, I made a point of being in India, because I've always had it in my mind that I would be there. Wrong, but I thought I would be. So I went to India, and in fact, he came very near dying right on his birthday. He had a serious episode of some kind of a seizure in the evening, and then the next morning he was just very, very unwell. And that next morning he was scheduled to fly to Europe. And Miriam was having to stand there to decide whether or not he could fly, whether he had to stay home. He was so unwell. We were literally feeding him with a spoon, and he was just completely bewildered. It was decided that we would fly. And so we got on the plane. And the way God is, we were in New Delhi at that point. The air conditioning in the New Delhi airport broke. So we were there like 2 hours. It was about 115. Then they put us in the plane, and it was so hot, they weren't sure they could take off. And there was no air conditioning in the plane, so we sat in the plane. All of this when Swami was just barely conscious. And I was with Leela and Miriam and I. There was no, Narayani wasn't traveling with him the same way then. And he was in first class, and so we upgraded to business class, and so we were in the row right behind him. The three of us were so out of it, things were falling out of our overhead bin, we were spilling everything on the floor. We named the trip the Three Stooges upgrade to business class. And Swamiji was just completely confused. And then I didn't help things by, he didn't know what time it was or what day it was, and I became completely confused. He had it right. I insisted that he was wrong. It was a terrible trip. We finally took off. We get to Europe. We go to Lugano. he was going to take a break up there. And again, he was very, he felt himself near death. And we were in the Lugano Hotel, and one in the evening, I was the only one there. And I said, Swamiji, perhaps you can die. And I always say, I don't know, if you want to go, I cannot and I would not stop you. But I don't think the Dante Hotel in Lugano is really the place. Seems like an odd place. So that gave me confidence. I thought maybe the lobby of the Biltmore worked for Master, but not room 316 of the Dante Hotel in Lugano. But he rallied, and David was there, and he couldn't walk, and he was in a wheelchair, and Switzerland was totally that part of Switzerland, totally unset up for wheelchairs. So we had four guys, I think Narya and Anand, maybe Arjuna, and we'd carry him up and down the stairs on the wheelchair. And he revived somewhat, but then by the time we got back to Assisi again, he was still so unwell that we, Narayani then, as I said, didn't live with him yet. So we all took turns and kept a 24-hour watch with him. He was never alone. And I was with him in the afternoon when he was just so weak, and he woke up from a nap, and he couldn't dress himself, just like an elderly person. So I went into the closet and I pulled out a beautiful blue silk shirt, and I, you know, had to put it on him like I used to have to do for my father, my earthly father. I buttoned up his shirt, and then he came out into the, with great help, he came out into the living room and stretched out on the couch. And I went back into his bedroom for some reason. And when I came back in, he was full length on the couch with his hands folded like this and his eyes closed. And I thought, oh my God. This is it, because this was the spot, just like this. But what had happened instead, actually, while I was out of the room, was that he'd had a vision of Master. And Master had come to him, and Swamiji said in the vision, as he described it, live or die, it really doesn't make any difference to me, whatever you wish. And then Master gave his life back to him. And I believe, without being able to say from super consciousness, that really was the hour of his death, but Master gave his life back to him. And we've always felt that all the years since then were extra. So anything that we had was extra. But he came out of that with the idea, I'll go back half a step. When I was putting that blue shirt on Swami in his room, I'm just, you know, making cheerful conversation. Oh, Swamiji, blue is such a beautiful color, so much nicer on you than orange. If only blue were the color of a Swami, you could wear it all the time. He said, why don't we make blue the color of Swamis? And then he said in the bedroom, I'm thinking about it. And then he went into the living room, was stretched out on the couch, and I walked out and came back, and I believe while I was out is when that experience happened for him. And then immediately, instead of being gone, he starts talking about this new renunciate order that he's going to start, that he's going to call the Naya Swami order. He sits up. I mean, we've been 24 hours a day. I was buttoning his shirt. That's where he was. He sits up. A few minutes later, he goes in and starts writing the book. And that night, he invites a group over, and he talks to us about the Naya Swami order. And he said, this is what Satan was trying to stop. This was the fight. This was the fight for my life, because this was about to happen and Satan was trying to stop it. And Master intervened. And over time, I actually wrote in the introduction to Swami's book, one says at one's peril that this is the most important book Swami has written, because he might just write another one, and you did say that one about the other one, so you're in a little bit of trouble. But I proposed that in its cumulative effect for the upliftment of the world, a new renunciate order for a new age may in fact be the most influential book he's ever written. And it happened right at that point. You know, there's so much about the life he lived. I intend to dedicate a lot of the years that are coming to writing down a whole lot of things that are in notes and in my mind, because I increasingly realize that much of this is not known. And he commissioned me, this is what he has wanted me to do. One last, and then I'll stop. There were many moments when he was in Los Angeles a couple of years ago, when he also was starting the work down there, and was also another time he ran a huge amount of karma through his body. So he was also, again, very, very unwell. That was when Narayani was just beginning to take care of him full time. And in a very extraordinary way, what he did do, and his life was extended because of her, he essentially gave all responsibility for the practical side of his life into her hands, with absolute trust that she would do whatever needed to be done. Extraordinary attunement of consciousness between them. And that was forming in Los Angeles. And often when I would go down there, I would end up just being with the two of them and him. And these were all Swamiji's goodbye seasons, you know, where he was really finishing a lot of business. And that was the time I had the conversation with him, because that was when the bliss state was really coming into him. And part of what was happening in Los Angeles was, because of the presence of Narayani, he was completely able to surrender, as I said. He didn't have to know what day it was. He didn't have to know what city he was in. He didn't have to know whether it was morning or night, where he was supposed to be. He didn't really have to make any decisions about his own life, because she was so intuitive in terms of his reality is, I won't put it in the past tense, that she would just do what he wanted to have done. So that also freed his consciousness to go just leave this world, which is really where he's been. Talking to Devi this morning, she said, you know what it was like in India. He just hasn't been in this world for a really long time, meaning this last year when we were there. Just hasn't been. He really hasn't, virtually hasn't known where he was. Just sort of would look around, like this. But his manifestation of his consciousness started shifting so radically. It started shifting when he went to India in 2003, but it was really, really shifting. The people have often said to me, has Swamiji changed since you first met him in 1969? And I had this conversation with Swami. I was talking to him. As all of you know, or as most of you know, I met Swami. He walked into a room in 1969. I was 22. He had not spoken a word, and somehow his vibration communicated to me the awareness that I was in the presence of a consciousness without boundaries. That was how I expressed it even then, and especially as I grew more sophisticated. There was no edge, just a force walked into the room, and it was a force of bliss, and it was exactly what I wanted. And he was himself 44. His whole demeanor was completely different. He was just starting to build Ananda. He had this huge mission he had to carry out. He was determined to be able to go to Master, as he just has done and said, you gave me a great work and I did it. So everything about the way he presented himself was different. But I didn't know any of that, because he just walked in and it was all vibration, so there was nothing else. And then there I was with him in Los Angeles and subsequent times, and you know, just such a different way of being. So I said, Swamiji, I have experienced you the same from the first moment I saw you until now. When people ask me if you have changed, I have to tell them that and say, the way you present yourself to the world has changed greatly. But I have to say that my experience of you is that you have always been the same. And because I write about him, I get to ask him those kinds of questions, because I can't put it in a book if it isn't true. And I said, may I say that? Is that true? Yes, he said. Just like that, yes. On another occasion when he said, I don't ever want to come back to this world, but oh, he said, I know myself. I'll probably come back to help you all. I said, well, that's the only reason you came this time, isn't it? Well, yes, he said, like that. You know, we've never been dealing with an ordinary consciousness. We've been dealing with someone who, for the fun of it, presented himself as a simple, unaffected friend, completely charming. As he said, if we relaxed in his presence, he felt he could help us more. He wrote about Master exactly the same way. Master was totally unaffected because if we could relax in his presence, he could give us more. Everything Swamiji says about Master, he's saying about himself. Including now, that beautiful picture of him kneeling at the feet of his guru again. Here I am, sir. I am your disciple. Huh. What joy. What a great celebration. Karen, do you think you're capable of singing that song? Swamiji wrote this beautiful song called John Anderson, which all of you know, and it's the story of a man and his wife, or a woman and her husband. It's the story of lifelong devotion and friendship. It's a romantic song, and Swamiji wrote it, you know, as a monk. But he sort of looked at it when somebody said something about it being a romantic song. Oh no, he said, this is a song about all of us and the life we've lived together in God. Swami himself wasn't capable of singing it for quite a long time because he could only get partway through. But the vibration and the words seem to say everything we want to say. Okay.
John Anderson, my John, when we were first acquaint, your locks were like the raven, your bonny brow was brent, but now your brow is pale, John, your locks are like the snow. Blessings on your frosty brow, John Anderson, my Joe. John Anderson, my Joe. John, we climb the hill together, and many a county day, John, we had within and there. Now we mourn a totter down, and John, and hand in hand we'll go, and sleep together at the foot. John Anderson, my Joe, John Anderson, my sweetheart, when first we two did meet, your locks were like the raven, your bonny brow was sleek. But now your brow is wrinkled, John, your locks are like the snow. But blessings on your frosty head, John Anderson, my sweet. John Anderson, sweetheart, we climbed the hill together, and many a lively day, John, we've had with one another. Now we must totter down, John, and hide. and sleep together at the foot. John Anderson.